Welcome back to Shattering This. Bubba J had to go and drink his beer, so he's no longer with us, but we still have Glenn on the line. I would like to turn our attention in this hour to the prophecy that we find in Yeshaya. It, at our end of our program yesterday, we were discussing Yeshaya 18:5. Now, I do want to put this in context, because I think you view anything out of context, you're capable of getting a wrong impression. The 17th chapter of Yeshaya opens with an announcement that Damascus will be destroyed and become a tangled heap of ruins. That didn't even seem remotely possible until the outbreak of the Syrian war. It says that ultimately the Syrian government is going to lose that war, something that does not look like it is likely at this point, but God has said that is what is going to happen, which means that the United States is going to most likely continue to supply the fundamentalist Muslims with ever more sophisticated weapons. It then says that as a result, that these roaming bands of terrorists motivate the world to thin Israel at the waist. So that the peace plan that Kerry is proposing that makes Israel so vulnerable, that is what is imposed on Israel. And since the 18th chapter opens with a overt condemnation of America, it's obviously America that is promoting this. And then as a immediately upon this peace treaty, which Yahweh says not only thins Israel at the waist, and the Kerry plan would narrow Israel to about 5 to 10 miles wide, where 70% of the Israeli population currently live, making the country no longer viable. And he knows it, by the way. The prophecy acknowledges this. And then it says that Yahweh is removing his children. There'll be 7,000 of his children, his covenant children, removed at this time, probably in the range of 4,000 from Gentile communities that have been adopted into the covenant, and about 3,000 from their descendants of Jacob, who are naturally born but have embraced the terms and conditions of the covenant. Then God says immediately thereafter that Islam, in unison, motivates, it's probably 150 million jihadists. God speaks of them being a flood of jihadists coming from a great many Islamic nations and in a great mass of humanity crashing into Israel from all directions, and that they are unstoppable, that Israel's defense forces are completely overwhelmed and unable to stop the tide of terror. God then says that he himself intervenes. And he blows the Muslims away. And he then goes into a summation of all the reasons that he despises Islam and uses terms that actually calls the terrorists those that are terrorizing in the name of Allah. And then he cites portions of the Quran that he says that he finds reprehensible. So God is leaving no doubt whatsoever of what is happening and who is doing what to whom. He then goes on to issue a warning and a condemnation of America and uses some 13 descriptive terms, which provide some 30 different character traits that nail America circa the 21st century. There's no doubt whatsoever that the United States of America is the country that he's railing against. Now, as we move through this, and God then says that he is establishing himself in Yisrael on his mountain, which would be Mount Moriah, as an opposition to what America stands for, what the world at that point stands for, so that everybody has a choice. You can choose to be with Yahweh or choose to be opposed to him, but those are your only two options at that point, and he's going to make his testimony available for the whole world to see simultaneously, and his voice available for everyone to listen to the world over simultaneously. That's his promise. But then he speaks of the difference between those who are embracing the terms in the covenant, answering his invitations to meet with him, and those who are unreceptive. And he says, indeed, before the approaching presence of the harvest, as the budding blossoms form and become completely perfect, speaking of the remaining Yisraelites who are now embracing the covenant and coming to know Yahweh, answering his invitations to meet. He says, then there are also those who are hardened and unfit, and they will be dealt with for becoming wild birds of prey, listening eagles, falcons, and hawks. And the insignificant and worthless who squander and trivialize will be stopped. They will be taken down. They'll be banished, snuffed out. So then with regard to the forsaken castaways, they will be rejected and removed, cut off, and separated. Since I was able to say it, and we are still on the air, to use Yahweh's own parlance, they will be goddamned, separated from God. Goddamn is a sentence, by the way. To damn is to separate. God damns religion. He damns militarism. He damns politics. He damns patriotism. He damns any assault on his land and his people, which is why Kerry's words are so dangerous if you're an American. Now, while there is far more to it than this, if I were to synthesize what differs between those who are saved and those who are not, it would be prioritization and receptiveness. Prioritization, framing the issue. Receptiveness, being open to the evidence. Prioritization and receptiveness. Does a person actually want to know Yahweh to the point that they're willing to devote the time and the focus required to Shamar Torah, to closely examine, to carefully consider his Torah guidance? Are they willing to accept what God has to say, even when, especially when, his testimony is in conflict with their religious beliefs? Those who are hard-headed, clinging to popular myths, will remain unfit. As is the case with much of what Yahweh says, there are multiple messages woven into his testimony. The metaphor of hardened buds being consumed by birds of prey is simple and yet enlightening. They could have flowered and flourished, but unreceptive to Yahweh's nurturing nature, they will have squandered their potential, and as a result will be plucked from the tree and die, consumed by others without their interest in mind. But the Natash, glistening eagles, falcons, and hawks, could be other than simple birds with feathers. It could also represent, and likely do, American warplanes doing what they were designed to accomplish. Man will kill man, as he has done throughout the ages. Those who die will be unknown to God. Having rejected his gift, they will be considered worthless. That sounds harsh until you realize that it is the only rational alternative, the only rational approach. If God got to know those who are either opposed to him directly or who are in relationships with false, demonically inspired deities like Allah or Jesus Christ or secular humanist elevation of man to supreme being. If God knew that they were corrupting his testimony individually and ignoring his Torah instructions, preferring to religious worship, then it would tear his heart out. Can you imagine billions of people and you come to know them and they're corrupt, and they're creating a false caricature of you that's modeled more after Satan than your actual nature. That you got to know billions of souls who reject your Torah, reject your invitations to meet, reject your covenant relationship, and have chosen to follow after all manner of lies and myths. Imagine how painful that would be. God's in a position where he can't know them. If he were to know them, then creation would be counterproductive. And he doesn't know them as a result. Now, he's keeping track of, he has messengers, envoys, whose job it is to keep track of the malfeasance of those who act against him, who aren't just victims of religion and politics and patriotism, but are perpetrators of those things. And so when it comes time to determine whether the likes of Paul and Constantine and Muhammad get to spend, Rabbi Akiva be another, that they get to spend their eternity separated from God in Sheol, which is the equivalent to being in a black hole forever, or they simply cease to exist, the evidence that has been collected against them will be revealed in a fair trial. They'll get to try their debate skills, if you will. But God himself is going to be the judge. And so you have this situation where God does not know those who have been victimized by the schemes of Islam and Judaism and Christianity and all forms of national political schemes. He can't know them. He can't let them into heaven, and he can't engage in a relationship with them. After all, he's established the terms and conditions for his relationship. If he were to allow them to be in a relationship with him, he'd be a liar, because they would all have violated the terms and conditions of this covenant. So this is the situation that we find ourselves in, and the God will is completely unknown to the vast preponderance of people, as those vast preponderance of people are unknown to God. They rejected his gift. They rejected his Torah. And therefore, they will be rejected by him. That's why he tells those who call him Lord, you're not coming to heaven. Get away from me, those of you who are Torahless, having squandered the benefits of the covenant by being unreceptive, hard-headed, if you will, to what Yahweh is offering, unwilling to consider what he has to say in his Torah. Those who are going to be vulnerable to the birds of prey will have squandered their own inheritance. Their lives will be considered irrelevant from God's perspective. Now, if somebody offers you a engraved invitation to a party that they're throwing on your behalf, where the attendees of those parties are lavished marvelous gifts, the most wonderful gifts that could even be imagined, and you don't even bother to read the invitation, then you should not expect the individual who is hosting that party in your honor, who is offering you those gifts, if only you'll attend, if only you'll read the invitation and be there to accept them. You would not be surprised, you should not be surprised, that he'd be a little bit miffed, that he'd be a little bit irritated. I know that if I offered Glenn the keys to my West Coast property and told Glenn that all you need to do, Glenn, is to show up and to have read the invitation so you know what you're being offered, and I'm willing to give you the keys to this. And I'm going to tell you, my gift of this home would be a gazillion times, I'll use a makeup number because there's no way to compare, is a gazillion times less valuable than what God is offering us. As a matter of fact, the home, even if I gave it to you free, would come with with liabilities that would probably not be in your interest, like the cost of the taxes and maintaining it wouldn't be a benefit. But imagine if I offered it to you free. Just come. It's yours. I'm offering it to you as a gift. Just read the cotton picking invitation and show up. And you said, nah, I'm not going to bother with the invitation. It's part of a book that I don't like. And I'm not coming. Would you expect would you expect me to put the gift of this house and my will to you under those circumstances, Glenn?
Look, I'm on Priceline. I got a $180 red eye tonight, the earliest I can.
I knew you'd react like that. But you understand the comparison here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, here's Yahweh offering anyone who will take the time to read his invitation and to meet with him. The most marvelous gifts that can be imagined. You get to be adopted by God. You get to live forever. You get to inherit the entire universe. And you get perfected. And then you get empowered and enriched so that you have ultimate understanding and ultimate opportunity. And you don't even bother to read the invitation. I mean, I think God would be just a wee bit miffed, don't you?
Well, not only that, but the thing is that people, then we read it, and then we say, oh, yeah, but it doesn't mean what it says. Yeah, I understand. I can read the words, but it's not what it really means.
We really shouldn't trust that the God who conceived DNA, which is a three-dimensional language, can convey effectively using a human alphabet, that he's really not a very good communicator, and we can, beyond the fact that he really didn't mean to say what we're reading, we really can't trust him. So why even bother with the invitations? That's kind of the argument that you're making here. I know that you're playing devil's advocate. That's not your argument, but that is the argument of the religious, is that we ought not. In fact, the whole religion of Judaism was based upon that, you know, an average individual can't understand Yahweh's Torah, so shouldn't endeavor to read it and should listen to rabbinic interpretations. Inference there is that God is not a very good communicator, and we really can't trust what we read.
You know, seventh to first, what's the difference?
First day of the week, seventh day of the week. Yeah, what's the difference? Easter, Passover, tabernacles, or Christmas. I mean, come on, what's the big deal, right?
Yeah.
So, old covenant, new covenant, multiple covenants, one covenant. Yeah, let's not quibble over terms. Let's not debate conditions. Let's not try to differentiate truth from lies. Let's just all throw it into a pot, and whatever we like, I'm sure God will be okay with. Doesn't sound rational to me. Doesn't even sound moral to me. It's important that we recognize that Yahweh has been extraordinarily generous. He has been amazingly forthright. He has made his introduction to himself available for all the world to see. The single most prolifically copied and well-maintained ancient text by an unbelievable margin over the second most actively copied and well-known, verifiable ancient text is the Torah. Nothing even comes close to it. The second to the Torah happens to be the Iliad, followed by the Odyssey, Homer's poems. And it's in the range of 1,000 to 1 in terms of ancient manuscripts and verification for one versus the other. We should recognize that Yahweh not only made his Torah available for anyone to read. His Torah is the first four books, or first five books, excuse me, or six, depending on your perspective, that comprise what is misknown and miscalled the Bible. It's the books of Bereshith in the beginning, Genesis, of Shemot, names corrupted to Exodus, of Kara, which means to be called out, to be invited, Leviticus, the book of Numbers, which is in the wilderness in Hebrew, Bamidbar, and then the book of words, Devarim in Hebrew, which was corrupted to Deuteronomy, as if it was a Greek text. Those five books comprise the Torah, along with Yahusha, the book miscalled Joshua, that means, Yahusha means Yahweh saves. It's a combination of Yahweh's name and the Hebrew word for salvation, Yahusha, which is considered by myself and others to be part of the Torah, because in it there is an open acknowledgement that Yahusha completed writing the Torah, which would mean that those words that he was writing were part of the Torah. But regardless if you view it as five or six books, there are more copies of it, billions of copies of it, than any other book in human history. And as a matter of fact, what's also interesting is the fidelity of the text is more consistent with the ancient documents than any ancient document in human history. Now, the Christian New Testament is rubbish. And there's more variations in the Christian New Testament between the oldest manuscripts and the manuscripts that are the basis of the English translations than there are words in the text itself. Been very carelessly maintained. And it's a much more recent revelation, you know, by sometimes as much as 1,500 to 2,000 years. So there's no document that's better preserved or more prolifically published than the Torah. But Yahweh doesn't just stop there. He went to great lengths to prove that his Torah was inspired by him. He gave us the his description of the Big Bang, of his account of how he created the energetic world, spiritual world, and also the physical world, and how he conceived life. And the account is precisely perfect and in complete accord with what we know to be true, and right down to the timing of it. And then he infused it with countless predictions that are all either have come true or are materializing before our very eyes to prove that it was inspired by a being that was not stuck in the ordinary flow of time, a being that had seen our future and reported in our past what he had witnessed, recognizing that the single most effective way to prove that you exist outside the constraints of time and that you are to be trusted is to accurately foretell what's going to happen and be precise in your explanations, and then to have everything that you've said to come true as you have revealed. And tens of thousands of prophecies, all of which have materialized before our very eyes or in the process of doing so right now. That's why we're studying Yeshayah 17 and 18. We're witnessing its fulfillment right before our very eyes. And the rest of it's inevitable. And so he proved his existence. God proved that he exists. For anyone who is informed and rational, if you use reason to assess probabilities, he proved beyond any doubt that he authored the Torah. And in the Torah, he not only introduces himself and tells us what he's like, and he explains why he authored the Torah, why he created the universe, which is to have a relationship with us. He introduces in that first book of the Torah this covenant relationship and describes how it was formed with the first individual who was to participate in it, so that we would know how to participate in it. And then he established in the next book of the Torah his nature, that he is our Savior, that he saves us from human oppression, from human religious and political, military and economic schemes, that he himself leads us away from those things so that we can have a relationship with him as our Father, us being his children, that he is the ultimate liberator and that his Torah is about liberation, about freedom, about family. In the next book, in Kara Invitations, he provides a written invitation for us to meet with him, to be called out of the world and to be part of his family. And he specifies the days and the purpose for those days in this engraved invitation from the creator of the universe to meet with him and be part of his family, to become immortal, to become perfected, to become adopted, to become enriched, to become empowered. All of it inscribed on our behalf. Later in that same book, after introducing these invitations, engraving them on our behalf, he tells us about his plan of time, which is all laid out in the Yobel, and his purpose. That there are special years, he said, that these special years would be about the liberation of those who are enslaved, freedom. That it would be about total forgiveness of debts, perfection. No longer being guilty or accountable, no longer being burdened in any way, and the return of the people to God's promised land. All of it there for us to analyze, all laid out with a specific formula of 6 + 1 = 7, so we would know how these events would play out through time. And he gave this to us, engraved it on our behalf. And all he wants of us is for us to prioritize this open letter to humanity from the very creator of the universe so that we'd read it, so we'd listen to what he has to say, that we'd come to know him as a result of doing so, and come to understand what he's offering and then respond appropriately. That's all he's asking of us. And yet, 1 in 1,000,000 people do it. Imagine, 1 in 1,000,000 people even bother to read the invitation to receive the most valuable gifts in the universe from the very creator of the universe. And if all but 1 in 1,000,000 discard it, don't bother with it. Can't be bothered, got too many other things I'd rather do. No, I'm not going to look at that. You know, I've been told that it's been annulled, that it can't be trusted, that that God is mean, that you can't understand what he has to say. Blah, blah, blah. That's where it is, folks. The invitation is available to anyone who wants to pick it up and read it. From the creator of the universe, he can be trusted. He's offering you everything that you could possibly want, expecting very little of you. 5 things really is all he asks. That you be willing to walk away from the lies, the corruption of religion and politics, of governance, of patriotism, militarism, of economic schemes. That you'd walk away from those kinds of things. Rather than trusting your country for your freedom and for your economic opportunity or whatever it might be, that you trust Yahweh instead. Now, to trust him, of course, you've got to get to know him. Can't trust someone you don't know. They call that faith. You can't rely on something you don't understand. They call that a belief. So you've got to get to know him. Well, it's all available right there in the Torah. Gave it all to you, everything you need to know. The answer to every important question is right there. Third thing he said is, I've given you these invitations to walk to me and become perfect. I myself walked that walk. I myself did everything that was required to enable this promise and to do so righteously. I'm offering to make you immortal. All you've got to do is answer the invitation. I'm offering to make you perfect. All you have to do is answer the invitation and meet with me. I've offered to adopt you into my family. All you've got to do is read the invitation and respond. I've offered to enrich you with everything I know. I've offered to empower you with everything that I have to give. All you have to do is accept it. And in this regard, you can't do any of those things unless you focus on, unless you take the time to closely examine and carefully consider the terms and conditions of the covenant. That's the one thing that you really need to do. If there's a do in this relationship, the do is to take the time to look at the terms and conditions of this covenant, because there's five of them. I've just articulated four. The last is, if you're a parent, we want you to circumcise your sons. That'll be the sign that you've signed this agreement. And then you need to understand that there are five benefits. And I'm accountable, God is saying, for giving you those five benefits. I've articulated what they are. It's the greatest gift in the universe. By golly, folks, this is an agreement. You need to understand who God is and what He's offering, and then engage according to the conditions that He's established. In one of the very few glimpses that we're given of what it will be like to be incarcerated forever in Sheol, it's not something that God speaks of very often, but here is an insight. If you want a glimpse as to what it will be like to be incarcerated forever in the black hole of Sheol, known by to most as hell, the Hebrew term is Sheol. It is the place of questioning. They shall actually and continually be abandoned and forever forsaken, altogether, completely, all at once, for the birds of prey in high places, and for the beasts of the realm. And they will be abruptly awakened in the summer with vexing and exasperating action taken against them. All manner of birds and prey, and also all kinds of beasts of the realm, will be among them, and they will be against them during the autumn and winter, continually ridiculing and taunting them for actually being irrational and consistently confused. That's Yahshua, Isaiah 18:6. It's very important to recognize what God is saying here and what He is not saying here. First, He is saying that those who are in opposition to Him, those who promote religion and militarism and politics and jaundiced economic schemes, that they are going to be forever forsaken. That's azab. And the English word that actually conveys that, but it has a bit of a religious connotation, is damn. That's why I've used it several times in today's program. They shall be damned, which means they shall be forsaken. They will be abandoned. Now, he's saying in this case that it's going to happen all together, completely and at once, because he's speaking of a specific audience. That is those, he's addressing America here. But it says that, you know, those who are in opposition to him, who have aided and abetted the enemies of Israel and his chosen people, that all together and at once, all as if they were one, they are going to be completely abandoned and forsaken all at once. Now, next, what is interesting here, and that's by the way, only happens once in human history. We're dealing with the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, where you are viewed either with God or opposed to Him. There is no middle ground. The great middle ground, great in size, not in what it represents, that the vast preponderance of those who reject Yahweh simply cease to exist upon their earthly demise. That will no longer be available. Everybody all together is going to be either with God, living forever with Him, or living forever opposed to Him. That's incarcerated. So it is an altogether situation which only occurs once in all of the human history. Now, for the birds of prey in high places and for the beasts of the realm, that's who's going to be, they're going to be with. The birds of prey in high places and the beasts of the realm. Who are the birds of prey in high places? That would be the elitist, the folks that were at the Trilateral Commission. John Kerry, for example. Obama, the Pope. Religious and political leaders in particular are going to be, those are the birds of prey in high places. But they're also going to be weak, the beasts of the realm. Yahweh uses the term beasts to describe those who are influenced by Satan, the demons. and they will be abruptly awakened, which means that they're going to die a mortal death. But in this case, death won't be the end of life. For the vast preponderance of people up to this point that have died estranged from God, who have paid no attention to the invitations to engage in a relationship with him, when they die, they're simply going to stay dead. You know, no punishment, no reward, no nothing. It's totally fair. But here now, they're not going to be able to stay dead. They're going to wish they could stay dead, but they're not. They're going to be abruptly awakened. And he says, in the summer, with vexing and exasperating action taking against them. But it's not God who is perpetrating this action. No. They're going to be awakened in the midst of their fellow birds of prey from high places and the demons. That's who is going to be exasperating them. That's who's going to be vexing them. After all, they're in the place of separation from God, the place where God cannot go. He's not there. All manner of birds and prey and every kind of beast of the realm. He's reemphasizing this. Those that are vexing and tormenting and anguishing are their comrades and the demons who followed Satan. Every kind of birds of prey, every kind of beast of the realm will be among them, will be against them during the autumn and winter, continually ridiculing and taunting them for actually being irrational and consistently confused. They're going to make fun of those they played for fools. That's why you don't want to be in the place of fools, which is Sheol, separated from God. I look forward to being with you at this time tomorrow.